We are the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short.
Hello, welcome to the In Conversation podcast series for the Association for Child and Adolescent Mental Health, or ACAM for short. I'm Jo Carlo, a freelance journalist with a specialism in psychology. Today I'm interviewing Professor Sam Wass, Professor of Early Years Neuroscience at University of East London Baby Development Lab. Sam led on the annual research review, There the Dance Is at the Still Point of the Turning World, Dynamic Systems Perspectives on Co-regulation and Dysregulation During Early Development, recently published in the Journal of Child Psychology and Psychiatry, commonly known as the JCPP. Sam is joined today by clinical psychologist Dr. Celia Smith, who is also an author of the research review, and Celia is currently leading a practitioner review on this for the JCPP. In today's podcast, we will focus on both the findings in the science-facing annual review on early child caregiver interactions and on the implications for practitioners. If you're a fan of our In Conversation series, please subscribe on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know how we did with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues. All listeners to this, and indeed any of the ACAM podcasts, are eligible for a free CPD certificate. Do please visit acamlearn.org for details of this, together with information on how you can access hundreds of hours of free talks, lectures, interviews, all of which you can also get free CPD certificates for. The URL is www.acamhlearn.org. Celia and Sam, welcome. Thank you for joining me. Can you each start with an introduction about who you are and what you do?
Hi, so I'm Professor Sam Wass, and I'm a professor of early years neuroscience. And I lead, as you mentioned, Jo, the Baby Dev Lab at the University of East London. So we do lots of research looking at kind of typical and atypical development, including typical development. So what we call basic science. We do a lot of research with kind of dyadic neuroimaging, as well as the research with home wearables that we're going to be talking about today. But the main focus of what we're going to be talking about today is obviously the work with atypical development. So we do work with children in early stages of developing conditions such as autism, ADHD, anxiety, as well as other kind of types of high-risk groups. So the reason I'm based out in East London is particularly we do a lot of work with socioeconomic diversity, children from diverse backgrounds, and looking at how that affects early development, as well as conditions such as preterm birth.
Great. Thank you, Sam. And Celia.
Well, thank you very much, Joe. Yeah, my name's Celia, and I worked with Sam for a long time now. I did my PhD with Sam several years ago in developmental psychology, a split between King's College London and University of East London. And I'm now just currently finishing up some advanced training as a clinical psychologist, also at King's College London. And at the moment, I split my time between clinical work and research. I currently work within the NHS Perinatal Mental Health Services in South London, and I'm soon moving to a specialist role within the NSPCC. And I suppose my areas of experience and interest and expertise are around parent-infant relationship, perinatal anxiety and other mental health difficulties, and also trauma. So thinking about birth trauma, attachment trauma, and also traumatic bereavement. But
Sam, can you start by giving us a brief overview of the methods used to study early child caregiver interactions?
So obviously this idea that we start off as a, in Shakespeare's terms, kind of a puking, mewling bundle, dependent on our parent for everything, and this way in which we transition from utter dependence on everything to kind of adult capable of kind of controlling themselves and managing their own mood. Obviously, this idea and this transition has gone back, you know, we've been thinking about this and talking about this since, you know, the very earliest stages of humanity. I guess kind of the scientific study of early child caregiver interactions. I just was organizing a conference. We had a wonderful talk from Sally Shuttleworth, who's a historian of science, who wrote this wonderful book, The Mind of the Child. And she was talking about how Darwin, in a lot of ways, was one of the first people to, you know, make this into a scientific field. He published this book about his early kind of observations of his baby, which then, you know, led to a lot of explosion of this type of thing amongst Victorian, mainly male scientists. And there's a lovely bit, Sally talks about how women in the Victorian age tried to get in on the act and tried to do some, you know, proper observations of parent-child interactions, and all the men were saying, "Don't be ridiculous, this is science, man's job." But obviously that gradually changed over time through to psychoanalysis. So obviously, you know, big field of kind of parent-child interaction, kind of Melanie Klein, that type of thing. And then, you know, in terms of stuff that we really still pay a lot of attention to nowadays, I guess, a lot of the really important work in early child caregiver interactions was kind of people like John Bowlby, Mary Ainsworth with her Strange Situation, which is still very, very, very influential in terms of kind of child psychology, leading on to really important figures like kind of Daniel Stern, Colwyn Trevathan, and so on and so on. But these are almost all based on qualitative observations of kind of scientists observing children in kind of home settings. So going back to the 70s or early 80s, we brought this thing of bringing parents and children into the lab and videoing them when these technologies first became available, and then observing the kind of microscopic details of their interactions. So, you know, this is work by fantastic work by people like Beatrice Beebe, Dan Messenger, Ed Tronick, Ruth Feldman, and Alan Fogel. So some really, really amazing work going back to then. I guess so far, the two big kind of tranches of understanding about child caregiver interaction come from these two methods. So qualitative observations over kind of long periods, and then these really, really detailed microanalytic observations of short bursts of interactions in the lab. But the thing that Celia and I are going to be talking about today is a new method that kind of Celia played a big role in pioneering as part of her PhD. And we're using it in quite a few different contexts. And this is about kind of using these miniature non-invasive wearable devices. So the ones we use are just a tiny, you know, about the size of a cigarette box. They clip onto a baby and caregivers in the home settings. You can record for a whole day. They record basically everything the child sees, everything that they hear, their physiology, so their heart rate, kind of GPS, parent-child proximity, and lots of other things as well that we can put on as add-ons. So this is giving us kind of the new ability to make in-depth quantitative long-form observations of how parents and children are interacting over potentially long periods. So we can, you know, be recording kind of days to weeks to months of data. And what we're going to be talking about today really is how this new method is driving new theory. So this is a bugbear of mine that, you know, the types of theories that we come up with in science are very much predicated on the observation methods that we're using. And you fit your theories to your data. And new observation methods that bring about with them a new type of data really kind of have the potential to both build on our current theories. We're going to be talking lots and lots about how the types of things that we can be looking at fit very well with ideas from John Bowlby and Mary Ainsworth and that type of stuff. But they also kind of drive kind of theory in new areas.
Celia, can you provide us with a brief overview of the clinical interactions currently available focused on child caregiver interaction in the 0-3 age range?
When it comes to child caregiver interactions, especially during those crucial first few years, the emphasis today does tend to be more on evidence-based sort of practical interventions that enhance the relationship between the two. But historically, early interventions around child caregiver relationships would have been more influenced by, as Sam described, more perhaps psychoanalytic theories. So, for instance, these approaches might involve a therapist helping often a mother explore how her own childhood experiences with her parents might be affecting her current relationship with her baby, aiming to uncover unconscious patterns impacting her caregiving. And though those ideas are still influential today, there was a significant shift in the development of attachment theory by Bowlby and Ainsworth, who focused a bit more on the present, perhaps observing how a child might cling to their caregiver when frightened, highlighting the need for a secure base. And this perspective has really laid the groundwork for interventions that emphasize sort of more real-time interactions or interactions in the here and now. And they focus on the immediate impact, I suppose, of the caregiver's behavior on the child's development. Now, in recent decades, this focus has sharpened a bit. The introduction of interactive interventions designed to make a tangible difference in the relationship. So, for instance, video interaction guidance. VIG uses video feedback to enhance interactions. This is where caregivers are filmed while interacting with their child with the guidance of a trained therapist, and they review the footage and together identify moments of attunement and try to reinforce those moments of kind of attunement connection. The Circle of Security Parenting Program is another approach that helps caregivers to understand their child's needs, both in terms of exploration and security. And that really focuses on helping caregivers to provide a secure base for their child to explore the world while also being available as a safe haven when the child needs comfort, a really attachment-focused intervention. Parent-child interaction therapy, for instance, is another key intervention, particularly effective for children who are displaying behaviours that can be quite challenging to other people, particularly the parent. And this approach involves kind of live coaching, during sessions where the caregiver receives real-time feedback from a therapist through an earpiece, for instance, as they interact with the child. And the idea that this might help caregivers learn to practice strategies that support and help regulate their child's behaviour while still paying attention to the relationship. These are just some examples of contemporary interventions, and they do tend to share overlapping goals and mechanisms such as enhancing caregiver responsiveness or contingency, but also things like understanding infant cues. And all of these are sort of thought to be really important for a child's healthy emotional and social development. Something that Sam and I will be getting to sort of talk about later on is perhaps where these interventions could be built on, could be strengthened, and where these interventions are already using ideas that perhaps we could transpose onto some of these findings that we're seeing through the wearable technology research.
Sina and Sam, as mentioned earlier, you are writing a practitioner review on this topic for the JCPP. I understand there are six key areas that you are focusing on, all relating to different processes of co-regulation and dysregulation in the parent-infant pair. Can you talk through each of these?
I think just to kind of start with as a general conception, so Celia already mentioned that one of the really big focuses, absolutely rightly, of a lot of interventions that are out there at the moment is this idea of contingency promoting. So this is this idea that it's important to be responsive to your child. And, you know, there's a massive amount of evidence there in a lot of different areas of psychopathology, you know, from caregivers with anxiety and depression through to things like kind of parent-child interaction in ADHD, lots and lots of different things. You know, contingency is lower. So parents are less likely to, you know, respond to something that their child says, or respond to a distress vocalization from the child, or to respond to their child's kind of nonverbal cues. And that has led to this idea that one of the things that we can usefully do to try to help kind of parent-child interactions where we're worried that, you know, they're not developing in a typical way is to improve this contingency, which is absolutely great. We completely agree with that. There's a ton of evidence, as I say, that supports this. What we're trying to do is try and go a little bit beyond that. So how can we be more kind of nuanced about this idea of contingency promoting? And each of these six areas kind of really kind of take it in a slightly different direction. So the first comes back to this idea of one of the really, really early aspects, and Ruth Feldman talks about this beautifully in her work. One of the really important core functions of early parent-child interaction is to help us manage what we're going to be calling today CNS arousal. So CNS is your central nervous system. And very, very coarsely, your CNS arousal is your overall levels of arousal and alertness within your brain and nervous system. We know that adults have relatively more stable kind of daily cycles of fluctuations in their day, in their levels of arousal and alertness. You know, we're more aroused and alert during the day and we're less at night. Obviously, a newborn baby not only has kind of very different patterns, so they're much more kind of faster cycles, their sleep-wake cycles are much faster, but they're also much more unstable. So if you look at kind of their patterning, it's much harder to predict where a child's arousal levels are going to be from their historical levels, you know, for a child than it is for an adult. So The key idea is that there's a sweet spot. So optimal arousal isn't when you're as calm as possible and isn't when you're as excited as possible. There's a sweet spot in the middle. This is kind of Yerkes Dodson first showed this more than 100 years ago. And one of the kind of key ideas that is kind of important for early parent-child interactions is that the function of co-regulation, so how parents are helping their children, is by helping them to keep in their optimal intermediate level of arousal as much as possible. Where this is important in intervention research is this idea that, you know, it's not just about helping your child to calm down. It's about responding to your child's arousal state and helping them to keep them in, you know, what some people call the Goldilocks zone, where you're kind of not too hot and not too cold. The other idea that's useful is when we're talking about downregulating, it's not just about, you know, keeping calm and helping the child to keep calm when they're excited. You know, different dyads have different sweet spots. You know, some dyads are naturally a more of a kind of hyper dyad. You know, we're quite hyper in my family. My kids are all quite hyper. And, you know, when my kids are highly aroused, I find it easier to shift to from kind of high arousal negative affect to high arousal positively excited about something than you do just to kind of get everyone to calm down. So those are the kind of two core ideas, this idea that, you know, arousal is somewhere kind of in the middle, and this idea that, you know, it's not just about kind of going from high to low, it's more nuanced than that.
Sam has described the science behind the first concept. Can you talk through what it means practically in terms of the clinical context?
So one of the points that Sam was making, based on the findings from some of this researchers that there's this sweet spot of physiological arousal or sort of central nervous system activity that infants and dyads perhaps function most of it. And that is something that we understand clinically in a different kind of language. So we talk about the window of tolerance, for example, and this is a term used to describe the range of emotional and physical states where an individual can function effectively. And when someone's within their window of tolerance, they're calm enough to think clearly and manage their emotions, especially, but still be alert and engaged with what's happening around them. What I would say is that this idea of the window of tolerance is often more applied to parents and thinking about parents helping them to stay in their optimal zone of arousal or central nervous system activity, and a bit less about helping infants or children to stay in theirs. As children get older, again, we start to see a bit more of those ideas being applied to children almost as many adults. But if we're thinking about really early childhood, that doesn't tend to be the case. Mm-hmm. Sometimes we do hear about practitioners thinking with parents about children's optimal level of stimulation in terms of if they have neurodevelopmental differences, that mean they need a higher level of stimulation, for example, than another child. We might be thinking a little bit about that idea of how do we provide that stimulation or lower that stimulation depending on what their baseline is. But it's not a really dominant idea within clinical practice. I wouldn't say it's a bit more of an idea that we see applied to older children and to adults.
Should I go on to this second one, Joe?
Yeah, please do. Yes.
Okay. So the second one is, you know, this really comes back to what we were talking about the start, about this idea that we have a massive amount of data that is videoing short child caregiver interactions, the type that you can easily do in the lab, or, you know, a researcher goes and visits them in the home and looks at them for 10 minutes. But we have virtually no data on these longer term rhythms, so these longer term fluctuations. So the next idea is this idea, which is quite well discussed in the literature. So Ruth Feldman's done some really beautiful work about, you know, as I was mentioning at the beginning, about this idea that an adult's long term rhythms tend to be more stable than a child, and how the child basically entrains to the caregiver's rhythms. And, you know, going back to Bronfenbrenner, he talked about a lot about this in the context of self-regulation, that the adult does the self-regulation for the child, and through that the child kind of internalizes the expectation of what a kind of a well-regulated state is. So it's there as a theoretical idea in the literature, but there's really virtually no kind of proper empirical work looking at how an adult's long-term rhythms influence a child's, just because we haven't had the techniques to measure it. The reason that this is really important is because these ideas of stable daily rhythms, there's one slide that I saw in a talk. It's one of those things you saw in a slide, and I haven't been able to find out kind of the citation of this slide, but it's imprinted on my memory, which is just, if you look at kind of day, night, sleep kind of cycles in typical adults and adults with mental health conditions, it's incredibly clear how it differentiates, that the day, night, sleep, night cycles are less clearly differentiated in a lot of different kind of mental health conditions. And this has certainly been, you know, my experience. I used to do Samaritans, and, you know, you'd constantly be getting phone calls in the middle of the night from people, and, you know, you'd say, well, it's the middle of the night, and it's like they're completely kind of unaware of it. So that's a really, really important area, because we think, you know, based on these very old theories that have been around a long time, that, you know, parents influence children's development very substantially through their own rhythms. But we really have very little data on whether that's happening and how that happens atypically in an atypical child interaction. So the other idea, which relates to this idea of long-term rhythms, is that this idea that how you respond to your child is not just predicated on kind of you in terms of your static state, but it's predicated on, you know, what state you're in at the time that the child is communicating to you. So this is something that any parent at home, you know, is completely obvious. You know, if you're in a bad mood as a parent and your kid starts tantruming, you react differently. But in terms of clinical kind of literature, it's a really amazingly underexplored, just because, as I say, we haven't had the methods to measure how these long-term fluctuations in a caregiver's state affects how they respond short-term.
Yeah, absolutely. So for some time in the field, we've been looking at this idea of, well, if we then support the parent with their own emotional, physiological well-being, perhaps that will be enough to scaffold their kind of caregiver-infant relationship, to enhance those interactions, to ameliorate any difficulties that might be coming up there. And Alan Stein did some really sort of critical work in this area, especially with depressed mothers and parents, but also with parents with a range of other mental health conditions as well. And the consensus opinion is that it's really not sufficient to target the parent's sort of needs alone. You really have to tackle both the parent's mental health difficulties or contextual challenges and the parent-child relationship together, if you only focus on one or not the other, the outcomes, the progress is quite limited. And this dual-focused approach helps make sure both areas get the attention they need to really improve. And this actually idea is really intuitive to lots of families. Mm-hmm. This idea that even if I'm doing quite well, if my child is really having difficulty, or if there's something in the relationship that's not quite right, that's going to make it harder for me to function, to be okay emotionally. So to kind of help both sides out is going to have a sort of exponentially sort of positive. If there is a big effort to nonetheless support parents with their emotional well-being or with their overall well-being in terms of thinking about things like their sleep cycle or their kind of own physiological rhythms, perhaps in terms of nutrition and other lifestyle factors. And a lot of that is provided through psychoeducation, trying to help parents understand how those different lifestyle factors can impact on their own stress levels and in turn perhaps affect the parent-child relationship. That kind of psychoeducation approach is within a number of different interventions. But as I say, that alone is thought not to be perhaps sufficient to really provide the most meaningful outcomes for both the child and the parent.
Such a huge area, isn't it? Let's go on to the third key area then, or the practitioner review. Sam, do you want to start?
So basically, this is something that we often talk about. So I do a lot of work as well as clinical facing work. I do a lot of education facing work. And I present this a lot to early years teachers who think about this a lot in the context of babies and toddlers, which is if your child that you're looking after gets upset, and they start crying, how do you respond? Try and keep as calm as you possibly can in order to show them the state that they should be in. Or do you empathize with them and kind of cartoon, oh, ouch, that looks really, really ouchy, and kind of temporarily kind of match your state to theirs in order to build this kind of empathic connection. And then from there, kind of help them to take it down. And it's really interesting because there's one of those things that they're in fact exactly the opposite response. In the context of talking about with toddlers, so there's an American psychiatrist, Harvey Karp, who talks about this. It certainly works really, really well with my kids. This idea that when you've got a tantruming toddler saying, you know, I want to pour orange juice on the cat, just the same thing again and again and again, rather than doing what most parents do, which is I'm having my authority challenge, so I'm going to be very calm and rational and talk in a very sensible voice and be very logical. He says that's not the way to kind of deal with a toddler. Much better is to match their state, narrate what they're saying, say, yeah, you really want to pour orange juice on the cat, match your vocal patterns to theirs, mm-hmm. match your speech rhythms to theirs to make them feel like they're understood, and then just shift them onto something else. And what we and a few other people now have shown is that in fact with babies, so it's a really interesting Gianluca Esposito in Singapore has done some work, as we've done a couple of papers, showing that in fact you get quite a similar pattern with babies. So when a child gets upset, when a baby that you're looking after, if you're measuring the stress, the arousal levels in the adult caregiver, you very reliably see kind of an upregulation in the adult's arousal levels at the time when a child has a peak kind of arousal moment. And then we've also shown actually in three separate data sets now that the more the parent child does that, so the more reliably they upregulate their state to match the child, the faster that helps the child to calm down. Mm. So this is another idea that Brad Cedar and I wanted to talk about for this practitioner review. This idea that it's not just about kind of setting a good example. In certain times and in certain settings, yeah, it's about kind of temporarily matching your state to the child. And then when the stimulation is no longer needed, then you gradually remove it. Obviously, this opens up tons of questions. Can you do it too much? You know, if a parent is getting very agitated with a crying baby and they're, you know, losing their temper and, you know, telling the child to stop crying, you know, what's the difference between that? That's also state matching. So what's the kind of the quote unquote good way to do it? And what's the quote unquote not good way to do it? Cedar, do you want to come in here?
Yeah, I think this idea, this kind of match and then help downregulate or then help calm is something that we see threads of in existing approaches. So the PACE model, the playfulness, acceptance, curiosity, empathy model, which is pioneered by Dan Hughes, is a really trauma-informed approach that aligns quite closely with this concept, particularly during moments of heightened emotion. So if, for example, a child reacts with anger or frustration to a trigger or a stressor, so say they get really upset when they're told they can't play on the swings, you know, an immediate typical response from a caregiver, particularly a caregiver who's sort of experienced trauma themselves, might be to reprimand the child for being rude or just dismiss their feelings. You don't need to play on those now. Go. And what's got into you today? Something along these lines, perhaps. But the PACE approach encourages caregivers to first acknowledge and then match the child's emotional intensity in, importantly, a non-judgmental and rhythmic tone to capture their experience. So, oh, wow, you're feeling really angry. You know, you think I'm being mean by not letting you go on the swings when you really want to go on the swings. And by doing this, the caregiver shows empathy, makes the child feel understood, but does so in a voice that facilitates this kind of open, light communication, allowing the caregiver to diffuse some of the heightened emotion and bring the arousal down. This idea we also see in a few other clinical practices, so sort of Incredible Years, Parents Inc., New Forest programs, which are more grounded in sort of social learning theory. And they teach parents strategies for supporting children who are quite prone to, you know, quite frequent sort of bursts of dysregulation. We also have some colleagues who work more psychodynamically and are informed more by psychoanalytic concepts. And actually, we can see some of these ideas around matching and then calming with young children in even some of these really early psychoanalytic discourses. We also see that in terms of Winnicott's mirror role, which is this similar idea of reflecting back the infant's emotions to them so that they can see these emotions and gain a sense of self through the parent's mirror role. And crucially, the parent doing that rather than expressing their own emotions in that moment. And then there are also really important clinician scientists now today who are showing how they apply some of those ideas. Beatrice Beebe talks about how caregivers should stay just slightly below the child's intensity level during emotional exchanges to help the child process emotions without becoming overwhelmed. And then we also have Feldman's work, who talks about a kind of acknowledging, imitating, elaborating chain, you know, a process where parents first sort of are able to acknowledge what's going on with the infant, can imitate it, can match it, and can then make it bigger, can elaborate it to support the child's sort of emotional cognitive development. And that's been shown to be something that's really linked to an overall sensitive, attuned, tingent style of caregiver interaction.
Let's move on to the fourth key area.
As I mentioned, this idea that contingency is important, so being responsive to your child is something that, you know, we want to be promoting through clinical interventions. And this is, as I said, you know, one way in which I think we can go a bit beyond this. So Celia actually did some research for her PhD, building on research that other people have shown about anxious parents can actually be over contingent. So with these home wearable data, she just looked at the correlation. So that how much, if a child was in a high arousal state, was the adult also likely to be in a high arousal state too? And she found that the associations between the child and the adult's arousal state was higher in kind of a community sample where the caregiver had elevated anxiety. So that's one of the areas where we can talk about kind of over contingency. Another area, which we're actually going to be getting onto a bit in the next one, is this idea of kind of oppositional parent-child interactions in ADHD. Mm-hmm. So if you have a lot of parent-child interactions where, you know, again, you talk to any parent and they're like, oh my God, yeah, of course. And this idea that you basically wind each other up in a relationship. Mm-hmm. But again, it's astonishingly underexplored in the clinical literature, just because it's virtually impossible to study. You bring parents and children onto the lab, and the way you interact with your children in the lab isn't, when I've got five cameras pointing at me, isn't the way I interact with my kids at home. And this is one area where we just have virtually no quantitative data, and it's really, really key. So basically, the idea of idea four is this idea that, you know, contingency, it's not just the case that more contingency is better. You can have over contingency as well as under contingent. Mm-hmm. People like Ed Tronick have been talking about this idea for a long time, but, you know, really important, we think, to be kind of thinking about how we can use this idea in intervention research.
Celia, you want to add something?
So this idea that Sam's talking about is something that aligns with a lot of clinical practice. So I imagine a number of listeners will recognize the concept of kind of good enough parenting within what Sam has described. So this idea that we're neither wanting to be overly contingent nor under contingent, but just sort of contingent enough. This idea of good enough parenting, Winnicott's idea, acknowledges that perfection in caregiving is neither necessary nor realistic, nor perhaps desirable. And rather what's needed is a level of responsiveness that meets the child's needs without overwhelming the parent or stifling the child's autonomy. And I think this kind of mid-range model of contingency, which is what Sam's really describing, reflects this idea that the best outcomes are achieved when parents provide sufficient support to make the child feel secure, but not so much that it hampers the child's independence or places undue strain on the parent. I think we also see a little bit of that parallel in terms of clinical practice with the mid-range model of contingency in various therapeutic approaches. So in parent-child interaction therapy, for instance, there's this phase called the child-directed interaction phase, where parents are coached to follow their child's lead when they're playing, sort of offering positive reinforcement while avoiding being overly controlling or disengaged. And this helps parents stay in optimal range of responsiveness, where they're supportive without being intrusive. And there's a subsequent phase in this intervention, which further reinforces this balance by teaching parents to manage their child's behaviour with clear and consistent commands that are neither sort of overly harsh nor overly lenient. By helping parents in this way, this intervention sort of is supporting the relationship to develop. I think we also probably are seeing this idea of like a mid-range model of contingency, or thinking about the potential downfall of overly contingent interaction or under contingent interaction in video interaction guidance. So in video interaction guidance, practitioners are sort of thinking about moments where perhaps an anxious parent really is engaging with their infant in such a way that the infant's not getting that much time off, that the infant perhaps is giving signals that actually they just need to look over to the side. They're actually a bit overwhelmed with this level of stimulation. And in VIG, although perhaps we're not necessarily pointing out moments where things aren't going well, what we might point out is moments where a parent was able to hold back from that level of stimulation, to not be quite so intrusive, and to see what effect that had on the interaction and on baby, and whether baby was more able to be kind of involved in the interaction at that moment. And then thinking about how can we get more of this in the interaction.
Let's go on to concept five.
Yeah, and this is actually quite related in a lot of ways. So we're used to thinking of kind of the function of the diet as co-regulation. Yeah, so we've been talking a lot about that. So, you know, parents shift their own state in order to help their child to maintain an optimal state, basically. And everything that we've been talking to up until now is about this idea of how we do this. But this is this idea that you can actually have parent-child involvement in dysregulation too. So if the parent, by responding to the child, can change the child's state in a way in which further moves the child further away from the optimal state. So this is quite an underexplored idea in the concepts of dyadic relationships. So there is some really nice work by Gerald Patterson that talks about this. Apart from that, it's a relatively underexplored area. It's much more explored in the context of intra-person dynamics. So in panic disorder, for example, you know, this idea that you get this kind of self-sustaining cycle. So, you know, I'm in a high arousal state, which causes me to be hypervigilant to my physiological symptoms, which causes me to become more convinced that I'm having a panic attack, which causes them to increase still further. And you get this kind of feed forward cycle. And it's basically the idea that exactly the same types of feed forward cycles can exist, but across a dyad. So a child is more aroused, so they'll be more oppositional, which then makes me more aroused as a caregiver, which makes me find it harder to see things from my child's point of view, which makes me be stricter. Maybe I shout at my child, which makes them more aroused, which makes them more oppositional. And you basically, as I say, just wind each other up. As I say, very, very hard to observe it actually happening. So consequently, really, really remarkably little work in the clinical literature on this area.
I suppose what Sam's described there in terms of the panic cycle will be really familiar to lots of listeners in terms of thinking about cognitive behavioral therapy, and which usually focuses on how thoughts, behaviors, emotions, physical sensations can interlink to create vicious cycles of stress, anxiety, low mood within themselves. And usually cognitive behavioral therapy is really oriented towards the individual. So it's sort of intra-individual. But what Sam's describing is perhaps like an application of these approaches to the diet, so an intra-dyadic vicious cycle. And although this isn't something that perhaps is sort of explicitly packaged up as an intervention in clinical practice, you can see that the ideas behind it are perhaps influencing parts of clinical practice. If we think about mindful parenting, which is intervention for parents about being fully present with your child, recognizing your own emotional reactions and sort of being able to catch your own thoughts and feelings as they're coming up, to kind of respond to those in an accepting way that means you don't get too wrapped up in them. And we can think about how that might be a powerful tool for breaking out of stressful cycles. Whether or not that's the case is sort of an area where perhaps there might need to be a bit more research to really see, like, what is it that actually breaks down those chains of intradyadic vicious cycles. So that's one area. And another area that I've been thinking about with colleagues recently is actually within the Circle of Security parenting program, which introduces this idea of sharp music, which is that uneasy feeling that parents sometimes get when their child behavior sort of triggers some deep-seated fear or anxiety, perhaps because it is reminiscent of something within their own childhood. We're not really aware of what's going on for us when the sharp music comes. Perhaps that might be a moment where stress is a little bit higher. We're a bit more likely to behave in ways that can escalate stress within the dyad that can contribute to that vicious cycle. But by becoming more aware of this, which is what Circle of Security program partly aims to do, the idea is that the parent can better sort of manage that emotional tension, that emotionally heightened state, and stay more connected with their child, more in tune, preventing stress from escalating.
the final concept that you'd like to highlight?
Yeah, so this is this idea about long-term adaptation. So one of the really popular metaphors when we're talking about parent-child co-regulation is that it's like a dance. So when you have a couple who are dancing, both partners are continually adapting to one another, you know, second by second, and that's how you keep in rhythm. And basically, you know, parent-child co-regulation is very like that. We've been talking about how it's not just about, you know, that the parent influencing the child, but it's also about how the parent is influenced by the child. Yeah, so it's bi-directional. We've been talking mostly about in terms of the short-term interactions, your moment by moment, how you influence one another. But you also get these interactions happening over a longer time scale too. There isn't just an optimal way of parenting, yet your parenting style is influenced by your child. And there are tons and tons of studies that have shown this in different ways, you know, adoption studies, you know, other studies looking at parents raising genetically unrelated children, you know, lots and lots of different ways. Just to give an example of this, one really, really important way in which some beautiful research by Jonathan Green at Manchester has looked at parents raising children in early stages of developing autism is looking at how a child with autism naturally responds in a different way to social communicative signals from their parents compared to other children, and looking at how that affects in turn how the caregiver interacts with their children. And they're just doing a beautiful intervention, just raising awareness of that in caregivers raising children with autism. You know, just be aware of the fact that how your child responds to you can influence how you in turn interact with your child. So the dyad kind of is adapting to one another over time. So it's still a dance, but it's a dance that happens over years as opposed to seconds and minutes.
Great, thank you. It was really comprehensive. Ideas around caregiver and infant interactions are often based around Western ideals. What do your reviews, so both the research and practitioner reviews, find in terms of cultural bias, and how can this be addressed?
So most research has focused on measuring child caregiver interactions through things like gaze and voice. However, studies have shown that while child caregiver pairs in Western societies often interact mainly through things like eye contact, vocalization, and things like showing objects, those in other cultures, perhaps African, Middle Eastern, Far Eastern cultures, tend to rely more on bodily contact and physical touch. So it is worth noting that most infant research has been dominated by Western perspectives, often actually focusing on caregiver-led interaction. And significant work in the, I'd say, the 1980s by researchers like Tronick, Cohn, and later by Beebe and Feldman, has actually highlighted the bidirectionality of these interactions, how both the child and caregiver influence each other. It's not just one or the other. And while this focus on bidirectionality also has its roots in Western research, it is being observed preliminarily in other cultures, particularly in the Middle East and West Asia. So there are signs that these ideas have broad application, but that said, we do need to remain open to the possibility that these patterns may not be universal. And we do need more exploration and focus in these areas to really fully understand how interactions play out across different contexts. And one of the things that we are really interested in is that looking ahead within the field of infant research, data-driven approaches like machine learning, like AI applied to sort of multimodal interaction data sets, might help reduce cultural biases that sometimes occur within more traditional research methods when investigating the caregiver-infant relationship. And these newer approaches might give us a more balanced understanding of sort of which aspects of interaction are most important to be thinking about in development without being limited by sort of preset ideas. I know that mentioning AI and machine learning also comes with its own sort of potential challenges and pitfalls. Mm-hmm. We know that machine learning is not invulnerable to cultural biases in itself, but this is an area that we're really interested in developing and within our lab, and which some of the PhD students that are working with Sam at the moment are currently pioneering, I would say, to really try and address this issue.
A question for both of you. What else is in the pipeline that you would like to share with us?
Yeah, so there's a couple of things that we're looking at the moment and developing on it. So one is a grant with Carlo Fincengo and Pasco Fearon, both of whom are editors of JCPP, based out in Amsterdam, looking at the early development of attachment. So this is what causes some children to develop secure attachment to their parent and not. Yeah, so this is a really, really foundational idea. It goes back to Mary Ainsworth. What we got some funding to look at with this grant is, can we look at something that, again, amazingly hasn't been looked at before, which is how the caregiver is responding to their child's distress in home settings. How does that then in turn affect how the child is communicating to their caregiver over time? And the other thing that we're looking at in a project that we're just developing at the moment with Celia and also with Emily Jones at Birkbeck is quite a different way of using wearables, which is, can we give these wearables to an individual child caregiver dyad, record them for, you know, a week long at home, and then analyze the data to give to your dyad, these are your specific triggers that trigger arousal dysregulation in your specific dyad. So this idea that you're actually giving people within the context of an intervention feedback, personalized feedback about what is causing arousal dysregulation in their dyad is a hugely complex issue. Is this something that we want to do? If so, how on earth do we do it in order to avoid one of any of the many, many pitfalls arise from it? So this is something, you know, we're just conducting some early stage, you know, is this possible? And some kind of lots and lots of consultations. So if it is possible, is it the kind of thing we want to do?
So much to explore. Very exciting. Finally, both of you, what are your take-home messages for our listeners?
So mine would be the dyad is something that we can study scientifically, we can observe and we can make predictions, we can build a computer model to predict how things are going to react within a dyad, but it's an amazingly complex system. It's really at the very, very cutting edge of, you know, what we can study and model in dynamic systems theory. So there's no one-size-fits-all optimal way to interact with your child. The optimal way to interact with your child varies in lots and lots of different ways across lots of different timescales, and there are lots and lots of different types of optimal. So dynamic systems are complex, but it doesn't mean that we shouldn't be trying to fix them when they're developing atypically in the context of clinical science.
Thank you. Celia?
I think my takeaway would be this point about the dual focus in interventions. If we're focusing solely on either the parent's mental health or the parent's context, and we're not thinking about the parent-child relationship, that's not going to lead to the most effective outcomes. We really need to be thinking about addressing both to see meaningful improvements. And the reason is that these two areas are really closely linked. When a parent is facing challenges, it can affect their relationship with their child and vice versa. So if you only address one part of the equation, the other aspect might still need attention. That's why a dual focus approach is so important.
Brilliant. Sam and Celia, thank you so much. It was absolutely fascinating. For more details on Professor Sam Woss and Dr. Celia Smith, please visit the ACAM website, www.acam.org, and Twitter at ACAM. ACAM is spelled A-C-A-M-H. And don't forget to follow us on your preferred streaming platform. Let us know if you enjoy the podcast with a rating or review, and do share with friends and colleagues.